The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Classic. The Bear Who Came to Dinner. The author had heard about wild animals that bonded with humans, but this 7-foot Goliath had claws that could shred a tree. He also had a remarkably understanding nature, and there's a picture of this big black bear sitting there on its haunches with its paws on its knees, staring out like it's meditating. Very interesting picture. I'm at Bosco in the remote wilderness near Mount Robinson in western Canada, at the end day of a long day of backpacking. I had made a lean-to in a clearing beside a stream and was preparing to catch supper. Then I looked up, and there he was, an enormous black bear, slowly circling the clearing within 30 yards. He wasn't Bosco to me yet, and I viewed his presence with trepidation. My provisions were vulnerable, if he was in a piratical mood, since I was unarmed. However, I decided to go about my fishing, and the bear came along. I've lived with wild creatures for 30 years, respecting their first fear, fast movements. So I let him see every slow, deliberate move I made. Soon he was sitting on his haunches, less than 5 feet away, intensely interested in my activity. When I landed a 14-inch lock-leven trout, I tossed it to him. He gulped without bothering to chew. And when I flipped out the fly again, he moved closer, planted his well-upholstered fanny on the turf beside my boot, and leaned half his 500 pounds against my right leg. When drizzly darkness set in, I was still fishing for that bear, fascinated as much by his gentle manners as by his insatiable capacity. I began to think of him as a friend, as in a friendly way as Big Bosco. I didn't mind when he followed me back to camp. After supper, I built up the fire, sat on the sleeping bag under the lean-to, and lit my pipe. All this time, Bosco had sat just outside the heat perimeter of the fire. But the moment I was comfortably settled, he walked over and sat down beside me. Overlooking the stench of wet fur, I rather enjoyed his warmth as we sat on the sleeping bag under the shelter. I listened to the rain thumping on the tarp in time with the wide, steady, powerful kurump, kurump of his heartbeat beneath his thick coat. When smoke blew our way, he snorted and sneezed, and I imitated most of his body movements, even the sneezing and snorting, swaying my head to every direction, sniffing the air as he did. Then Bosco began licking my hands. Guessing what he wanted, I got him a handful of salt. He enthusiastically nailed my hand to the ground with his 4-inch claws, claws capable of peeling the bark from a full-grown cedar, claws that carried his 500-odd pounds at full gallop to the top of the tallest tree, claws that could rip a man's body like a bandsaw. Finally, the last grain of salt was gone, and again we sat together. I wondered if this could be for real. Bosco stood up on all fours, burped a long, fishy belch, and stepped out into the rainy blackness, but he soon was back with a message. He sat down near the sleeping bag and attempted to scratch that area of his rump just above his tail, but he couldn't reach it. Again and again he nudged me and growled savagely at the itch. Finally I got the message and laid a light hand on his back. He flattened out to occupy the total 7 feet of the lean-to as I began to scratch through the dense, oily hair. Then the full significance of his visit hit me. Just above his stubby tail, several gorged ticks were dangerously embedded in the swollen flesh. When I twisted out the first parasite, I thought I was in for a mauling. His roar shook the forest. But I determined to finish the job. Each time I removed a tick, I showed it to him for a sniff, before dropping it in the fire, and by the last one he was affably licking my hand. A cold, sniffling nose awakened me several times during the night, as the bear came and went. He left the sleeping bag wetter and muddier each time he crawled around over me, but he never put his full weight down when he touched any part of my body. The next day I set off again, over a ridge, down through a chilly river, up the next crest, through the thickest of birch and alder and down a wide, north-running river canyon. To my surprise, Bosco followed like a faithful dog, digging grubs or bulbs when I stopped to rest. That evening, I fished for Bosco's supper. As the days passed and I hiked north, I used a system of trout, salt, and scratch rewards to teach the bear to respond to the call Bosco. One evening he walked over to the log where I was enjoying my pipe and began to dig at my boots. When I stood up, he led me straight to a dead hollow tree into which he clawed unsuccessfully. Returning to camp, I covered my head with mosquito netting, tied shirt and pants and glove openings, and got the hatchet. I built a smoke fire near the base of the tree and hacked away until the hollow shell crashed to the earth, split wide open, and exposed the hive's total summer production. For my understanding and efforts, I received 3 stinging welts. Bosco ate 20 pounds of honeycomb, bee bread, and hundreds of bees. He snored most of that night at the foot of the deep sleeping bag. At campsites, Bosco never tolerated long periods of relaxation and reflection. And true to my sucker form, where animals are concerned, I babied his every whim. When he wanted his back scratched, I scratched. When he wanted a fish dinner, I fished. When he wanted to romp and roll with me in the meadow, I romped and rolled, and still wear the scars to prove that he played games constantly out of my league. During one particularly rough session, I tackled his right front leg, bowling him over on his back. As I sat there on his belly, regretting wind, he retaliated with a left hook that not only opened a 2-inch gash down the front of my chin, but also spun me across the meadow. When I woke up, Bosco was licking my wound. His shame and remorse were inconsolable. He sat down with his ears back and bawled like a whipped pup when I was able to put my arm around his neck and repeat all of the soft ursine vocabulary he had taught me. It is not my intention to either attribute character traits to the bear that he could not possess or exaggerate those he had. I simply studied him for what he was and saw him manifest only the normal qualities of his species, which were formidable enough without exaggeration. Other than calling him Bosco, I never attempted human training upon him. On the contrary, I did everything possible to train myself to become a brother bear. The affection we developed for each other was spontaneous and genuinely brotherly. When it occurred to him to waddle over my way on his hind legs, grab me up in a smothering bear hug, and express an overflowing emotion with a face licking, I went along with it for 2 reasons. First, I was crazy about that varmint. Second, I nourished a healthy respect for what one swat from that ambidextrous giant could accomplish. Although his size and strength made Bosco almost invulnerable to attack by other animals, he had his own collection of phobias. Thunder and lightning made him cringe and whine. When Whiskey Jacks flew into the camp looking for food, he fled in terror, the cacophonic birds power diving and pecking him out of sight. Bosco's phenomenal sense of smell amazed me. Trudging along behind me, he would suddenly stop, sniff the air, and make a beeline for a big, succulent mushroom 200 yards away, to a flat rock across the river under which chipmunks had warehoused their winter seed supply, or to a berry patch 2 ridges over. One afternoon, when we were crossing a heath where dwarf willows grew in hedge-like clumps, Bosco suddenly reared up and let out a "Bwah!" I could detect no reason for alarm, but Bosco stood erect and forbid me to move. He advanced, began to snarl, and pandemonium broke out. Every clump of willows sprouted an upright bear. Black bear, brown bear, cinnamon bear, and 1 champagne, all subdivisions of the same species. But these were young bears, 2-year-olds, and no match for Bosco. He charged his closest contestant with the fury of a Sherman tank, and before the 2-year-old could pick himself up, Bosco dispatched a 2nd bear and tore into a thicket to dislodge a 3rd. At the end of the circuit, my gladiator friend remembered me and scoured back, unscathed and still champion. That night we sat longer than usual at the campfire. Bosco nudged, pawed, talked at great length, and looked at me in the eye before allowing me to retire. In my ignorance, I assumed it was a rehash of the afternoon's battle. He was gone most of the night. Along toward the next mid-afternoon, I sensed something was wrong. Bosco didn't forage, but clung to my heels. I was looking over a streamside campsite when the big bear about-faced broke into a headlong swinging look up the hill he had just descended. I didn't call to him as we went over the crest full steam without once looking back. That evening I cooked supper with 1 eye on the hillside, then lay awake for hours waiting for the familiar nudge. By morning I was desolated. I knew I should never again see Big Brother Bosco. He left behind a relationship I shall treasure. Robert Franklin Leslie wrote 10 books about his adventures in the wild, his most famous, The Bears and I, was made into a 1974 Disney movie. Patrick Wayne, John Wayne's son, played Leslie. This article originally appeared in the December 1964 edition of Reader's Digest. I'll tell you what, that's kind of brave. And this next article is an article of national interest. A young deputy's brief but traumatic career reveals the hidden crises faces police in towns large and small. And it's called The Weight of the Badge. And there's a picture of Patrolman Jeff Corris, who's returned to the site where he and a fellow officer killed a man who fired a gun at them in 2016. Unlike Tom Conley, he sought help. On the morning of the funeral, scores of police officers and sheriff deputies filed toward the front of St. Teresa's Catholic Church, saluting as they passed a black plaque and a silver urn. The plaque commemorated the summer morning in 2016, when after only a few months on the job, Sergeant Thomas Conley opened fire on a suspect during a deadly standoff. The urn marked the autumn evening 14 months later when Tom turned his own gun on himself. The 29-year-old's death had deeply shaken the Lansdale County Sheriff's Office, whose 18 sworn officers were accustomed to dealing with suicides in this vast rural stretch of northern Wisconsin, but never one of their own. It had stunned his parents. What had they missed? For answers, they turned to Dave Corris, a friend and retired police commander. Although he had not known Tom personally, he now stepped to the altar to deliver the eulogy. Police took officers to some of the darkest places in America, he said, scenes often called critical incidents. Tom had a critical instance as a police officer, Dave said. Although most officers never fire their weapons in the line of duty, police fatally shoot about 1,000 people each year, according to data compiled by the Washington Post. Some of these instances trigger public outrage or prosecutions. But even when officers are cleared of wrongdoing and hailed as heroes for their action, they can come away from shootings deeply damaged. Dave knew firsthand his own son. Jeff Corris, a patrolman in St. Paul, Minnesota, had been involved in a fatal confrontation with an armed suspect only a few weeks before Tom's incident, he told the mourners. What he didn't say was that he had heard his son's shouts on the police scanner hours before he could hug him to make sure he was okay, or how afterward his son had stopped telling people he was a police officer. The problem with us as first responders, Dave continued, is that we take care of others, but we don't want to be other people's problems. We want to be the one that's standing tall. Tom's suicide had spawned Dave to ask his own son how he was coping, he said. Now he begged the church full of officers and their relatives to do the same. Those things that we pick up throughout our career can get heavy, he said. Tom Connolly was a small-town electrician itching for something bigger. Fifth among 11 children, he had been the quiet center of their boisterous Connolly clan. But the slightly built boy also displayed a protective streak, once chasing down a bully who'd insulted one of his sisters. By his mid-20s, when a cousin became deputy and shared stories of car chases and drug busts, Tom decided to follow suit. His father, George Connolly, excitedly called Dave Corris with the news. They had met on a North Dakota Air Force base in 1977. Later, when George became a commercial pilot and Dave became a cop, they kept in close touch by telephone. Now Dave sounded a note of caution. It was a precarious moment in becoming a law enforcement officer in America. White police officers had killed unarmed black men in Ferguson, Missouri, and on Staten Island in New York, setting off widespread protests about police brutality and inspiring the Black Lives Matter movement. When the two officers were later shot outside the Ferguson police station, a new slogan, Blue Lives Matter, also went viral, deepening the divide. Fatal attacks on law enforcement in the United States have fallen significantly since the early 1970s, but the job remains one of the country's most dangerous and stressful, and law enforcement officers face a 54% higher risk of suicide than the general population, according to John Vellante, a retired officer who studies police stress at the University of Buffalo. Of all the traumatic things officers see on the job, Vellante says, shootings are the biggest stressors. Although the media coverage often focuses on confrontations in major cities, half of all fatal police shootings occur in small towns or cities with populations of fewer than 100,000. Yet smaller departments such as Langelades are less likely to have the resources to help officers in the aftermath. Dave Corris told George Connolly to keep a close tabs on Tom, but he also tried to reassure his friend. The chances that something could go seriously wrong were lower in a place like Langsdale County than in St. Paul, where his son had been on night patrol for 6 years without firing his weapon. That would change a few months later. At around 3:30 a.m. on May 9, 2016, Jeff Corse and his partner heard a call come over the St. Paul police radio. A man was dragging a woman out of a nearby store at gunpoint. "We've got shots fired," an officer suddenly shouted over the radio. As Jeff pulled up, gunfire crackled. His partner ran toward the woman, who lay on the ground bleeding and screaming for help. Moments earlier, Jafforth Smith, a 33-year-old man who had replaced his schizophrenia medication with methamphetamine, had shot her in the face. By the time Jeff arrived, Smith was firing a handgun at the officers. Jeff doesn't remember screaming for Smith to drop the gun, or when Smith refused, the sound of his own Glock going off 5 times. He and 3 other officers, all white, had shot Smith, who was black, at least 12 times. When authorities released the names of the 4 officers the following day, Jeff worried that he would be next in the national spotlight. But the story quickly faded from the headlines. Jeff was told to return to work after only 3 days off, though he first had to meet with a St. Paul police psychologist, one of 3 mandatory meetings for officers involved in shootings. Although Jeff would eventually be recommended for a Medal of Honor, he stopped telling neighbors that he was an officer. After Ferguson, he had stopped driving to work in his uniform and tended his car windows. Now he started carrying his concealed weapon everywhere. Within a few weeks, Jeff's jaw began to lock up, and he was grinding his teeth in his sleep. "He was thinking about leaving the force," he said. His father sent him to a police psychologist specializing in the use of eye movement desensitization and reprocessing to treat trauma. After 3 visits, Jeff's symptoms had begun to subside. Then on July 26, 2016, his dad called to say that Tom Connolly had just been involved in a fatal shooting. For an hour, Tom Connolly watched through his sights of his AR-15 as Scott Menard begged officers to shoot him. The 50-year-old had a long criminal record, mostly for theft. He struggled with addiction that had deepened after his daughter killed herself. Police had begun investigating him again over a stolen gun. Menard told friends he'd rather be shot than return to jail. On July 26, 2016, an officer spotted him driving a stolen car and pulled him over. Menard, drunk and high, stuck the stolen gun out the window and fired wildly before speeding off. A 120-mile-hour chase ended on a dead-end road at the edge of a field of grain as a family of 7 huddled in a farmhouse basement nearby. The officers closest to Menard pleaded with him to drop his weapon. Their interactions were recorded by police, and the videos were later released to the Post. "Why don't you just show us your hands?" said Joseph Husnick, the officer who'd stopped Menard. "Then everybody will put their guns down. So far, you're lucky nobody got hurt, right?" "You've got to think about your kids right now," Lincoln County investigator Randy Ballow added. Instead, Menard paced just outside his car, texting a friend goodbye. He told officers they'd have to kill him. As an armored vehicle approached, he raised his rifle. Husnick, Rullo, and another officer opened fire. Tom Connolly also pulled his trigger. Menard fell to the dirt. "Suicide by cop," is how his ex-wife, Tammy Menard, would later describe the shooting by the Post. The standoff was the first in more than a decade that an officer from Tom's department had fired a weapon at a suspect. Tom had been a deputy for just 6 months. "We call him a traffic Nazi. He loved to go out and do traffic stops," said Tim Gisner, the cousin who inspired Tom to go into law enforcement. "But from the start, his family said, that ignorance took a toll. A few weeks in, Tom was called to an accident in which a teacher had been struck by a truck while cycling to work. He tried to resuscitate her, but she was already dead," recalled his mother, Bob Connolly. "It was one of the few times he discussed his job with her. He said, 'Mom, she did everything right. She wore a helmet, she was riding safely, and she still got hit.' He soon saw other bodies, mostly car crashes and overdoses, so many that car workers gave him a macabre moniker, Fatal Tom. Tom was finishing up a 12-hour overnight shift when he heard Husnick call for backup and joined the chase of Menard. Of the 26 rounds officered fired that morning, only 1 came from Tom. Even so, he was put on paid administrative leave as state investigators sifted through the evidence. Tom seemed shaken when he told his girlfriend, Brittany Thrall, about the shooting. He began to cry before quickly burying his emotions. He didn't bring it up again, Thrall recalled. As the days of leave wore on, Tom's mood darkened. It was a long time to have a potential homicide charge hanging over his head, Garrett said. He didn't even know if he hit the guy. He hadn't concluded state investigators, who ruled in October 2016 that the shooting was justified. Tom returned to patrol after 2 months off. Almost immediately, he joined a search for a missing 3-year-old boy, who was found alive the next morning. The incident and others involving children weighed on him, said younger sister Laura Bailey, a nurse at a children's hospital in Milwaukee. Then on April 9, 2017, his beloved 6-year-old cousin, Gracie, drowned during a birthday pool party. I never heard him cry, his mother recalls, but when I had to tell him about Gracie, he sobbed. He was absolutely devastated. Weeks after the little girl's funeral, Tom was promoted to sergeant. But his relationship with his girlfriend was unraveling, partly, Thrall says, because his job had left him afraid to have kids. In September, he surprised his superiors by giving up his sergeant rank to work during the day. He said he didn't know if he could do this anymore, recalled Sergeant Kevin Eisen. A few days later, Bailey was in town visiting their mother. She and Tom had made plans to have lunch, but when his sister texted him, he said he was busy. Upset, Bailey invited him over for dinner, but Tom, who'd always dropped everything to see her, never came. Instead, he began drinking. He and Thrall got into an argument. When she left, Tom went into his basement where he kept his guns. As soon as he picked up the phone, Dave Kors could tell that something was wrong. All John Conley could do was sob. Tommy said had killed himself. Police officers are adept at hiding the warning signs. They are scared of losing their guns if they speak openly about their mental illness, says the Roderman Family Foundation, Miriam Hyman, who has studied police suicides. That fear is not unfounded. As a result, many departments develop a culture of silence. Barbara Connelly went through her son's things. She found the black plaque praising his bravery during the deadly standoff. She discovered the bike he stopped riding after the teacher's cycling accident, and a photo of Tom holding Gracie as a toddler. When she searched his computer, she found a meme he'd saved off the squad car with an officer inside. Our job is keeping 99% of the population safe from the other 1%, it said. The problem is we have to spend half of our lives with that 1%. And the better we do our job, the less the other 99% think they need us. The only ones paying attention on the streets are the cops and the criminals. It was a sight of her son she had never seen. After his funeral, an honor guard carried Tom's ashes to the cemetery where they were put atop a grave right next to Gracie's. Then it was time for the last call. Langlade calling 444, a dispatcher said. There was silence. Sergeant Thomas Connelly, you are now clear to end tour, she said. May you rest in peace. We have watch from here. How you can help? Consider become a certified mental health first aid responder. The 8-hour class will teach you how to recognize and respond to the signs of mental illness. For information, go to mentalhealthfirstaid.org. Well, Halloween is past, but let's do a couple of laugh lines kind of targeted towards Halloween. I would die first in a horror movie because I refuse to spend the last few minutes of my life running. Any ghost sophisticated enough to haunt a hotel is going to find a 13th floor, whether you have an elevator button for it or not. How about a horror game show called The Price is Right Behind You? I know blood in horror movies is just corn syrup, but it's still terrifying because at this point in my life, that's basically all my blood is. Every movie is a horror movie when the characters don't use coasters. The rule of age 10. Want to find a key to happiness? Think about what excited you the most when you were in the fifth grade, and do it now. And there's a picture of a little girl with wings on her back and a flyer's hat with goggles pointing up. Everyone who works at NASA or NASA, I can't even pronounce NASA this morning. That's terrible. NASA or Google or SpaceX got excited about science before he or she was 10 years old. TV host Bill the Science Guy and I said recently, this is well documented. If it isn't 10, it's 11 or 12. But it ain't 17, I'll tell you that much. You can plainly see the 10-year-old inside Nye, who is now 63, just as you can see the 10-year-old anyone else who works at the junction where their deep happiness meets the world's deep needs. Walter Murch, the Oscar-winning film editor who likewise discovered his passion in childhood, followed a Twistler, perhaps more typical, career path than the lifelong science geeks. You can't do kid stuff for a living, he was told. Kid stuff, in this case, meaning fooling around with a friend's dad's tape recorder, sampling snippets of sound. He was steered toward more practical pursuits, such as engineering and oceanography. 40-odd years later, Murch landed in a movie business, and one day it dawned on him why this new job, film editing, felt so right. It scratched the same itch that splicing audio had all those years ago in his pal's basement. I was doing almost exactly what excited me most when I was 10, he said. Murch wondered whether he'd stumbled on a general rule. What if this was really love doing between the ages of 9 and 11 is what most of us ought to be doing, somehow, for our actual job as adults? If that's true, he thought, then our life satisfaction depends rather heavily on recalling precisely what that thing was, on remembering who we were during that unique developmental stage, where everything that's in us shows up for the first time. While I was researching my book, U-Turn, what if you woke up one morning and realized you were living the wrong life? A pattern emerged that seemed to confirm Murch's insight. Among the hundreds of stories and midlife career changes I sifted through, the rule of age 10 came up over and over again. These were the lives of aha moments, decades delayed, and of better late than never course corrections, back in the direction of those early enthusiasms, falling coordinates established before what we caught to do, according to parents and teachers and other well-meaning adults, began to smother what we loved and who we were. The trend was so striking that after I finished writing that book, I started telling everyone who was floundering in midlife, try to remember what you were all about when you were 10. If you kept a diary, dig it out. If you're still in contact with friends from that era, call them up and ask them who you were. What's so special about age 10? A 10-year-old is a tiny superhero. At the ages of his or her powers in many ways, physical coordination, as any soccer parent will tell you, suddenly gels. If we could maintain our body functions as they are at age 10, said Leonard Gazelian, a research scientist at the University of Chicago, we'd expect to live about 5,000 years on average. Growth actually slows for a year or two, but only on the outside. The real show is happening in the brain. At age 10, kids graduate from being biologists, searching for the theory of life, to being philosophers, grappling with the truth that no one escapes death. The surge in bandwidth helps 10-year-old kids reconcile what they think with how they feel. At age 10, a kid may suddenly become the family's truth-teller. You guys are boring, said her eldest daughter, casually eviscerating her mom at dinner after being told not to read her Harry Potter book at the table. Dad just talks about sports, and you just talked about problems at work. And Mom, your new glasses are kind of ugly. Just saying. Her voice was chillingly without effect, and I'm not sure about the hair. And then, almost in the next breath, this girl was as sensitive as a sandpapered fingertip. Not to her feelings particularly, but to the idea that the world was full of people who were not her and who felt differently, the beginning of empathy. At around age 10 also comes the birth of taste. Take a memo, parents. Expose your kids to more beauty and less tripe, for what they learn to like right now will register forever. At 10, the lights come on full beam, revealing the road ahead. Professional athletes choose their sport. Lifelong rooting affiliations solidify. A worldview, the beginning of political affiliation, forms. Cornell University psychologists found that a commitment to environmentalism often traces directly back to the wild nature that kids were exposed to before the age of 11. As kids figure out who they are, they start kicking around their future lives, sometimes in elaborate detail. Graphic designer and podcaster Debbie Millman discovered as an adult a drawing that she made as a young girl. It predicted my whole life, she recalled recently. There she was, 10-year-old-ish, Debbie, on the streets of Manhattan. I'm walking with my mother. There are buildings and buses and taxis and cleaners. I labeled everything. In the middle of the street, there's a delivery truck. The sign on the side says, "Lady Lay's Potato Chips." When she found that old drawing, Millman was after many career meanderings drawing logos for a living in New York City. One of her clients was PepsiCo, which owns Frito-Lay. "I still have a journal from fourth grade or so, 10 years old," writer Mary Carr reveals. One of the entries says, "When I grow up, I will write one half poetry and one half autobiography. I also say I'm not very successful as a little girl. When I grow up, it will probably be a mess." Carr, who had an up-and-down life and spent some time in mental institutions, bloomed into a memoirist with three acclaimed bestsellers. Gary Vaynerchuk, a Belarusian-born entrepreneur and self-described digital media hustler, recently dug up his fourth-grade yearbook, which was plastered with pictures of players from his newly adopted football team, the New York Jets. "This was the first Americana for me," he recalled. "It's like one of the first moments of caring about anything in this country." At 43, Vaynerchuk is still obsessed with the Jets, but in a different way. He wants to buy them. He probably will. The term inner child got kicked to the curb sometimes around the turn of the millennium. But folks, grab a shovel. It's time to resurrect that inner child, because the stilled voice of the kid in you, specifically the 10-year-old kid in you, was never needed to be heard more. At age 10 is a developmental sweet spot. You're old enough to know what lights you up, yet not so old that the adults have extinguished that fire by dumping more practical and realistic options on it. In other words, age 10 is our source code. In the past, as many as 85% of North Americans said they failed to find much meaning in their jobs and would take a pay cut in exchange for a more fulfilling position. The charged fire hose of the Internet makes sure we drink before we're thirsty, or maybe more accurately, before we decided what we're thirsty for. The most reliable signal of what might actually fulfill us is getting lost in the noise. If you really listen, though, you can hear it. 10-year-olds are about to experience the biggest surge in intellectual horsepower in their lifetimes, as measured by gains in executive function. But with those gains will come some losses, as the divergent thinking of childhood starts to give way to practicality and logic. 10-year-olds are transitioning, in other words, from dreamers to lawyers. "I was a real artist until I turned 11, cartoonist Leanna Fink called in a recent interview. At 11, she started trying to be a professional. That changed everything. The personality trait of openness related to childlike state of receptive curiosity dampens as we grow older, studies show. So your life's work, if you're an artist, is a project of undoing, of lifting your foot off the brake so you're painstakingly learned to feather. But here's the thing. This whole project of recovering the inner kid is complicated, not because more of us haven't seen that kid a long time. And even if we were to perfectly remember what lit us up at 10, there's still a matter of how to scale that feeling to the adult world of today. How to age our childhood gifts, as the writer and podcaster James Altucher recently put it, to give them value in our lives right now. Even if you ripped the page out of your age 10 diary that explicitly stated your deepest desire, it'd be hard to take that to the bank today. When I was 10, I wanted to be in advertising. My wife preferred it if I stuck to those marching orders. We might be living in a house with an actual yard. Then again, I'd be hawking wrinkle cream. So I guess the recipe is you take that 10-year-old voice, run it through the filter of what you can live with, and make peace with the result. Make way for ducklings. At one Alaska library, you can check out the raven, then check out an actual raven. The Alaska Resources Library and Information Services offers hundreds of taxidermy animals, which is one of the benefits of living in nature's biggest wildlife playground. Amazingly, the fee for an overdue animal is the same as for a book, and the preserved pets can perform multiple functions. No Liberia Seal Erosion. We have a snowy owl that has been reserved for several occasions for a Harry Potter-themed party. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. I just finished the Reader's Digest for October. As I'm looking at purchasing a new vehicle, your article couldn't have been themed better. It's very thorough and has provided me with knowledge I need. Thank you. Your article could also alert consumers that the front windshield holds much of the technology to provide eyesight, and that small stone crack may develop a lengthy line crack across the windshield as it is in our 2016 Subaru. It is an expensive repair, even with insurance. Editor's note. You're right that the cost of replacing new windshields are increasing because of the required sensor calibrations. It's an issue we're continuing to look into. Cracks, dirt, and debris on your windshield can cause problems. But that's not the only trouble area. In many models, there are sensors all around the car. Damage to a bumper, fender, or side mirror could cause the sensors there to no longer work and add to the cost of the repair. And I'll do a little editorial stuff here. My car was backed into a few months ago, apparently in the parking lot by a large vehicle. I didn't even notice, I don't know when it happened because I didn't even notice the damage. That it turned out that when it did, it actually broke several small pieces of equipment inside, ended up almost a $5,000 repair. I read with great interest your story about the driver assistant crash prevention systems. My car has lane assist and forward collision warning. Both have been activated by shadows, which can be a big problem. I can always tell when a buy one, get one free offer will be in the next week grocery circular. Inspector has suddenly doubled the regular price on an everyday item, but only for a few days. A regular price like that would make any shopper irregular. Thank you for the review of the TV. Should you buy an 8K TV? CR Insights, August 2019. You discussed many relevant details, but failed to mention the screen finish and reflections. I watch in a room with ambient light. Virtually all modern flat-screen TVs are glossy and have annoying reflections. In our labs, we've seen most TVs move to a glossy finish. While there's not much you can do about reflection, some TVs are more reflective than others. If you're looking at displays in a store, wait for a dark part of the demo video to catch a reflection of the ceiling lights. That should give you an idea of what to expect. And then there's a place of long-lasting appliances. Thank you for your article on the most reliable appliance brands revealed, August 2019. We did that. All brands require appliance repairs at one time or another, but it's hard to tell if any real support to consumers. A few years ago, I was forced to replace a $2,500 range after waiting 2 months for a crucial part that was protectionally back-ordered. The fact that my five-year-old range wound up in a landfill still makes me furious. I'm interested in buying from companies that do not view their appliances as disposable. Editor's note. We are aware that customer service around repairs is a real problem for consumers, and we plan to look into the topic in even more depth in the future. Thank you for your excellent review of appliances. However, in 2016, the appliance manufacturer Hauer purchased GE appliances. You did not mention this. Editor's note, in our product surveys, we asked members about whether the products they had own have broken or stopped working as they should, and use that data to make predictions about how new models of a given brand will hold up over time. Regardless of who manufactures a product, the real-world experiences of how it holds up will show up in our data. How critical is it that I rotate my tires regularly? This common maintenance task, which should typically be done every 5,000 to 8,000 miles, isn't one you should ignore. It may seem minor, but remember tires are the only thing that comes between your 2-ton vehicle and the road. Well-maintained tires will help you travel safely for tens of thousands of miles. Without rotation, tires may not wear evenly. Front tires play a large role in braking, and on the front-wheel drive vehicles, they must claw for traction, which means they wear out more quickly. Plus, minute variations in suspension and alignment can introduce uneven wear patterns. All of this can impact your car's ride and noise level, as well as the tire's longevity. Spreading wear around all four tires measures even tried death and grip, says Chris Jones, a certified mechanic and tire technician for Consumer Reports. A visit to the mechanic is also an opportunity for a pro to inspect your tires for damage and proper inflation. Your owner's manual will have guidance on the rotation pattern. Some are front to rear, others side to side, and frequency. Tire rotations can cost up to $60. But shop around. Some retailers may find the service free of charge. My health insurance deductible and premiums keep going up. What can I do to save on cost? As health care costs rise, Americans are bearing more of the burden of paying for it. The average deductible, which you pay before insurance kicks in for a single person with work-based insurance, is up 39% from 5 years ago to $1,573 in 2018, while the annual premiums jumped 21% on average. Of $55.47 for family coverage. People who buy their own plans through the Federal Affordable Care Act, exchanges are also paying a lot more for health insurance. The benchmark plan for those who don't get subsidies to lower the premiums costs an average of $477 per month in 2019, up 33% from 2017. Most of the same is expected in 2020, so you're right to be cost conscious. While choosing a plan this fall, says Dada Rostaro, senior money editor at Consumer Reports, start with a careful comparison of plans. What plans cover and cost changes, probably more than you'd expect. So don't assume last year's selection will still be the best fit. It could be a lot costier this time around. Another great way to keep costs in check is to find a flexible spending account or health savings account. Those tax-free dollars you put away will make what you spend on care go that much further. And don't forget to use the wide range of free preventive medical services available on most plans. Taking care of yourself now could prevent the need for more expensive care later, Rosado says. How can I keep my black clothing from fading? Wearing black never goes out of style, except for if your clothes are faded and covered in fuzzies or detergent streaks. The more you wash black clothing, the more dye washes away, especially with black denim. Before you toss your black garment in the washer, turn it inside out to shield it from the agitation of tumbling or your machine, which breaks down the fibers and fabrics and causes them to appear faded. Some detergents won't dissolve well in very cold water, which can cause streaks. Use cool or warm water, generally above 60 degrees Fahrenheit, to help detergents dissolve and keep them fibers from losing their color. Too much detergent can also cause streaks, so be sure to measure out the recommended amount and don't use detergents with bleach or bleach alternatives, which can discolor black dye. Last, set dark loads at the light soil setting. It's gentler and on its shortest cycle possible. Less time in the wash means less fading. How you dry your darks matters, too. Tumbling in the dryer roughs up the surface of the fibers, creating a halo of fuzz that catches light and makes black clothing appear faded. Instead, keep the garments turned inside out and hang them to dry indoors. Avoid drying outdoors where the sun can fade them. Now, here's an interesting statistic. How likely are you to hit a deer? Fall driving means more deer are active and more people are driving on darker roads due to the shorter daylight hours, said Jen Stockberger, Director of Operations at the Consumer Reports Auto Test Center. Deer are most active at dawn and between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m., so use your high beams, Stockberger says. If you're about to hit a deer, don't swerve, just brake. Swerving can cause you to lose control and crash into another car, both scenarios that could result in more injury than striking an animal. And don't count on aftermarket deer whistles that attach to front bumpers to scare them off. Deer reaction is too unpredictable. Though automatic emergency braking and forward collision warnings can help, your seatbelt is still the best defense for minimizing injury. Past research has found that more than half of people killed in animal vehicle collisions weren't wearing their seatbelts. Also, be extra vigilant in high-rise states, such as West Virginia, and having been a deer slayer myself a number of years ago, believe me, it ain't fun. And it lists them all. It looks like the highest-ranking ones are, of course, North Carolina, Virginia, and South Carolina. Tennessee's pretty bad, though, as is New York. It looks like 1 in 98 things of the odds. Ooh, that's kind of scary. The time travel for fire safety. This is Consumer Reports. In 1925, President Calvin Coolidge proclaims the first National Fire Prevention Week in the month of October. In 1939, each year, 200 people are burned to death using inflammable cleaning liquids in the home, CR reports. Our testing reveals that these are those that are unsafe. In 1944, we test a product called the Match King, a lighter that has a metal match and flint strip, and find that the flame often envelops the entire match, making it a fire hazard. 1951, less than 2% of Americans have a fire extinguisher in their home, CR says. CR shows readers the types available, such as the hand-powered water model, along with a guide for when and how to use them. In 1964, some fire extinguishers name carbon tet, producing poisonous gas when used on a fire. Our chemists say not to buy this type. By 1970, the Food and Drug Administration bans carbon tet home use products. 1968, we warn against 100% acrylic carpets, A large part of the market due to flammable risk and testing. 10 out of 14 all acrylic samples catch fire. In 1976, we ignite 4 fire types. None have set off our heat-triggered sprinklers. Only smoke detectors work. 1994, we test fire extinguishers outdoors on a remote section of CR property. A Buckeye model is one of the best performers, and I have a picture of it here. In 2019, our labs have been recording response times of photoelectric ionization and dual smoke detectors for fires for well over a decade. Today's top-rated dual model is listed below. It's the First Alert 3120B. It costs $30. Got a 91 over score. And let's talk about something a little more tasty than fire safety. How about peanut butter cups? The classic milk chocolate Reese's peanut butter cup has been around since 1928. Today, Reese's and other brands tout a ton of tempting new options, including dark chocolate and organic ingredients. But does that make them a healthier choice? Our nutritionists say that a dark chocolate cup, which is richer in antioxidants, is indeed better than a milk chocolate one. And organic can mean better ingredients. But you still need to check labels before biting in. We compared 3 national brands of dark chocolate peanut butter cups. While the calorie counts are all similar, Theo cups are much lower in sodium and sugar than the other two and use the highest quality ingredients of the 3, with the main ingredient being cocoa beans and roasted peanuts. Both Theo and Justin's are organic, which means they cannot contain synthetic ingredients such as those found in Reese's. But don't forget that even the best of the bunch is still candy, says CR nutritionist Amy Rearing. I've got pictures of 3 very delicious-looking peanut butter cups. Theo Organic Dark Chocolate Peanut Butter, 210 calories, 15 grams of sugar, 6 grams of saturated fat, 58 milligrams of sodium, and the serving size is 2 peanut butter cups. Justin's Organic Dark Chocolate Peanut Butter, calories 220, sugar 16 grams, saturated fat 7 grams, sodium 120 milligrams, wow, serving size 40 grams, 2 peanut butter cups. And Reese's Dark Chocolate Peanut Butter, calories 200, sugars 18 grams, saturated fat 5 grams, sodium 125 milligrams, and the serving size is 39 grams of 2 peanut butter cups. Product Spotlight, Tankless Water Heaters. The storage tank water heaters are the most common type. Tankless water heaters are gaining market share with a reputation for running more efficiently, potentially saving you money over time. That's appealing given that heating water is the average U.S. home's second highest utility cost after heating and cooling the house itself. Switching types is expensive when a factor in pro installation, but if your storage tank water heater is failing or you're building a new home, a tankless water heater is worth the risk. We tested electric and gas whole house models, including those from Bosch, Navan, Rheem, and Trunk Tankless, to see how they compare with storage models. We did not find meaningful performance differences between the brands within a type. All were adequate, so our chart compares types rather than scoring models. The storage tank is typically holds between 30 and 50 gallons and 80 gallons. It's usually 5 foot tall or larger and 1.5 feet across. How they work. These continuously heat water, so when you ask for hot water, it's ready with no lag time. But that means you're paying for heat water whether you need it or not. Approximate purchase and installation cost, $570 electric, $600 gas for a 50-gallon tank. Larger capacities cost more. Add $600 to $800 for pro installation and more if your existing hookups are not compatible. The annual use cost, $245 for gas, $580 for electric. Testing performance. Both gas and electric boilers easily delivered a steady supply of hot water. They reached our target temperature of 120 degrees Fahrenheit, whether the incoming water was 58 degrees Fahrenheit or 74 degrees Fahrenheit. And tankless, heat the water as it passes through. And it's much smaller. It's 1.5 feet high by 2 feet wide. These heat water only when you turn on the tap. Depending on your unit's power and the temperature of your groundwater, you may need to wait for water to get hot. The cost is $525 to $1,150. At $800 to $1,500 per pro installation, plus some models may require upgrades to your gas pipes and home electrical service. $195 for gas for operating annual use, $535 for electric, so obviously electric's much more expensive to run. Gas models hit our target water output temperature of 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Two electric models, a Bosch and a Rheem, did when the incoming water was 74 degrees Fahrenheit, but not when it was 58 degrees Fahrenheit. So obviously, if your water is warmer when it's coming in, tankless is the way to go. And do more with a vacuum leaf blower. If you spend a lot of time piling and bagging leaves each fall, a vacuum leaf blower might seem like a tempting one-tool solution. With a built-in vacuum mode and snap-on leaf collector bags, these blowers can suck up leaves and shred them with some promise to reduce leaves into a 12th or even a 16th of their original volume. That means fewer bags to put at the curb. Though the electric plug-in Toro shown above, and there's a picture of it, keeps that mulching promise, our testing revealed that the other family vacuum blowers don't quite. We tested 13 models. Some shredded leaves down to only a third or a quarter of the original volume, and collected just a small quantity of leaves before the bag got full. The vacuum on most leaf blowers isn't designed to deal with huge piles of leaves, explained Misha Kalantar, CR's leaf blower tester. Also, we haven't seen any vacuums or battery-powered models, which can be more convenient than gas or corded types. However, the right vacuum blower could still save you time and effort if you have a small yard, or if you want to surgically sup up leaves around bushes and flower beds. To see full ratings, go to cr.org/leafblower 2019. And that's interesting because it's the mostly you see people blowing them rather than sucking them up. And then we have snack bars for kids. Many companies now offer healthy snack bars for kids. The distinct from adult bars is that they are generally a bit smaller, can be heavy on the chocolate offerings, and may have drawings of dinosaurs on the packaging. But does that really make them a good choice for kids? Our nutrition experts evaluated the ingredients and nutritional information for 12 different kids' snack bars. When it comes to kids, calories aren't the main concern, says Amy Keating, RD, a CR nutritionist. Instead, our testing and scoring weighed factors such as natural versus added sugars, whole versus refined grains, and isolated proteins. Processed sources of protein versus protein from whole foods. For example, some bars contain processed sources of fiber and protein, such as inulin, but fiber is best for you when it comes from minimally processed whole foods, such as oats or other grains. We also noted whether rice products were used, because CR research has shown that rice may contain worrying amounts of arsenic. Our two top-rated bars contain no rice, fewer added sugars, and no processed protein or fiber. Several others aren't as helpful as the wrapper might suggest. The RX bar for kids' chocolate cheap protein bar, $1.34 for the bar, is number one. Number two is Quaker Kids organic whole grain bars. That's $1 a bar. Made Good chocolate chip granola bars at $1.13 is the third best. And Kashi by Kids organic superfood bites chocolate at 80 cents a bar is the fourth best. And then you have this bar, Skays Lives Kids Chocolate Chip Dynamite Bars, Kind Kids Chewy Chocolate Chip Granola Bars, Annie's Organic Chewy Chocolate Chip Granola Bars, and Nature's Path Organic Enviro Kids Chewy Chocolate Chip Granola Bars. All of those are satisfactory. Let's do a quick rundown on recalls. Mazda vehicles. Mazda's recalling 9,340 of its 2019 Mazda 3 sedans because the head restraints may not lock into place, which raises the risk of injury in a crash, according to the National Highway Safety Administration. Because of improper installation of the seat cover material of the driver and front passenger seat backs, the material may interfere with the head restraint lock mechanism button, causing the button to be stuck in the released position. In this condition, the restraint can be moved freely and can't lock into the vertical height adjustment or the desired position. If a crash were to occur, the NHTSA says the head restraint could become loose and injure occupants in the vehicle. The vehicles were built from January 15, 2019 to May 22, 2019. What to do? Owners may contact Mazda Customer Service at 800-222-5500. Dealers will install spacers at the bottom of the lock release button or front seat head restraints at no charge to owners. Smoke and fire alarms. Universal Security Instruments recalling about 180,000 battery-powered smoke and fire alarms because they can have a misaligned internal switch, causing the alarm to not activate properly, posing a risk of failure to alert a fire. The alarms, oh, that's good. That's really good. The alarms were sold online through specialty wholesalers and others from July 2015 to December 2016 for about $20. What to do? Inspect the smoke alarm to determine whether it will activate appropriately. Press the test button, and if the alarm sounds, no further action is needed. Additional instructions are on the company website at universalsecurity.com. If the smoke alarm does not sound during the test, contact Universal Security for a replacement at 877-612-6955. Porter Cable Portable Table Saws. Porter Cable is recalling about 285,000 10-inch table saws because the motor can overheat, creating a fire hazard. The saws were sold at Lowe's from June 2016 to December 2018 for $100 to $180. What to do? Stop using the table saw. Contact Chang Type, the manufacturer, at 877-206-7151 or go to therecall.com/PCSaw for details and a refund. Fitz and Floyd mugs. Lifetime Brands is recalling about 150,000 Fitz and Floyd Nivea White mugs because the mug can crack or break when used with or exposed to hot liquids. Kind of defeats that purpose, doesn't it? Posing burn and laceration hazards. The mugs were sold at Bed Bath & Beyond stores and online at bedbathandbeyond.com from January 2013 through April 2019 for $8 to $10 for the mug alone and $30 for a four-piece dinnerware set. What to do? Stop using the mug? Call Lifetime Brands at 888-561-2269 or go to fitzloyd.com for details to get a free replacement mug that works, obviously. Well, let's close out with a couple of all in a day's work jokes. A man came through my lane at the grocery store with a jug of wine and a bouquet of roses. But before paying, he set the two items aside and says, "I'll be right back." He ran off, only to return a minute later with a second jug of wine and another bouquet of roses. "Two girlfriends?" I asked. "No," I said, "just one really angry one." And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so very much for listening.